This is Steve Carroll, and you're listening to the EM Basic Podcast. Today we'll be doing a topic podcast on diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA. We'll also talk briefly about hyperosmolar hyperglycemic state, or HHS, since it's part of the DKA spectrum. We'll go over how to make the diagnosis and how to manage these sick patients while they're in the emergency department. We'll also go over a few pearls about pediatric DKA management. Before we get started, just a quick announcement that you can now follow EM Basic on Twitter. Just search for EM Basic, all one word, and you'll find it. I'll tweet when new episodes are posted and with anything else interesting I find on the EM interwebs. I also want to thank Rob Orman from the ERCast podcast for the recent mention of EM Basic on his podcast on febrile infants. So welcome to any new listeners that may be out there. I hope you like what you hear. Also, one more thing. I just got a new microphone setup going, and to answer a few questions, yes, it was a Christmas present, and yes, I am a giant nerd. All that being said, I hope you enjoy the improved audio quality. As always, this podcast doesn't represent the views or opinions of the U.S. Army, the Department of Defense, or the Shawshank EM Residency. So let's get started. The first thing we need to talk about is the definition of DKA and HHS. In general, you'll see DKA in type 1 diabetics and HHS in type 2 diabetics, but type 1 diabetics can also get HHS and type 2 diabetics can get DKA. I'm sure just about everyone knows this, but just a quick reminder that type 1 diabetics have an absolute deficiency of insulin. When they don't have sufficient insulin, the body burns fat for energy, which produces ketones. I promise that this will be quick, but if you go back to organic chemistry, ketone bodies have hydrogen ions that dissociate near the body's natural pH of 7.4, so therefore this causes acidosis. And that's about all I remember from organic chemistry, thank you very much. On the other hand, type 2 diabetics have a resistance to the action of insulin, so as a consequence, they do not produce ketone bodies because they still have circulating insulin. So let's talk about the definition of DKA. The nice thing about the abbreviation is that it tells you the definition. For a person to have DKA, they have to have hyperglycemia with a blood sugar over 250, they need to have ketones in their blood or urine, and they need to be acidotic with a pH of 7.3 or below. Let's go over that one more time with letters of DKA. Diabetic, blood sugar over 250, ketoacidosis, ketones in the blood or urine, and acidosis, pH of 7.3 or less. The reason why we need to know these criteria is that just having a high blood sugar doesn't necessarily mean that the patient is in DKA. A patient could spike their blood sugar to 400 or 500 by eating a lot of carbs and not taking their insulin right away, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they are instantly in DKA. DKA is a process where a lack of insulin for a period of time causes certain metabolic derangements because the body is starved for glucose and has to compensate by burning fat for fuel. Sometimes this period is a few hours, sometimes it's several days. We'll talk about HHS briefly because the management is very similar and it can be present in the same patients as DKA. The main difference is that the blood sugar is much more elevated in HHS, but patients lack the acidosis and ketosis that is seen in DKA. Now, if the patient is vomiting for some reason, then they may have small ketones in their urine just from vomiting, but they don't have the large amount of ketones in their urine that you'll see in DKA. For HHS, you'll need a blood sugar over 800 without evidence of ketosis or acidosis with a high serum osmolarity. Osmolarity is a measure of the solute concentration in the blood, and for HHS, the osmolarity is over 320. These patients have a blood sugar that is so high that their blood is basically a sugary sludge. These patients frequently present with altered mental status and will often be comatose, which is much less common in patients with DKA. Another major difference between HHS and DKA is that the fluid deficits are much higher in those with HHS. On average, patients with DKA are 4 to 6 liters of fluid down, whereas HHS patients are 9 to 10 liters down. Let's summarize the intro one more time. DKA patients are usually type 1 diabetics, and they have a blood sugar over 250, ketones in the blood and or urine, and a serum pH of 7.3 or below. They are about 4 to 5 liters of fluid down. HHS are usually type 2 diabetics who have blood sugar over 800 without ketosis or acidosis, but with a very high serum osmolarity. They often present with altered mental status, and they are 9 to 10 liters of fluid down. From here on out, we'll talk mostly about DKA, since it's much more common than HHS, but the management from here on out is pretty much the same for both. The first thing to know about DKA are the physical exam findings that you can see from the foot of the bed before you even talk to the patient. Patients in DKA will frequently have a characteristic respiratory pattern called Kussmaul's respirations. what you'll see is that the patient is breathing very fast and very deep, but doesn't seem to be in any actual distress. This signals a patient who is acidotic because the hyperventilation is a response to a low pH. When the serum pH drops, the body compensates by blowing off CO2 in order to compensate for the acidosis. It's sometimes very pronounced, and you can see it from across the room. This should tip you off that the patient has DKA. A lot of textbooks talk about a patient's breath having a fruity odor from the ketones. However, this is only present in about 30% of those with DKA. In addition, I've also heard that some people don't have the ability to smell acetone, so don't hang your hat on this exam finding. While you're getting the patient's history, make sure that the patient is getting a finger stick and IV access with blood draw, and get it sent off for a venous blood gas. These patients can get sick very quickly, so having two large bore IV lines is often a good idea. When you're getting the history, be sure to identify the cause of the DKA. Inciting causes of DKA fall into seven categories that you can remember from the seven I's mnemonic. This stands for infection, infarction, iatrogenic, incision, intoxication, initial, and insulin. So let's talk about each of these precipitating factors quickly. So infection, you want to look out for signs of an underlying pneumonia or UTI or other infection. Infarction, this can be either a stroke, MI, or any other physiologic stress. Iatrogenic, so this refers to the patient's provider changing the insulin dose. Incision, this refers to the patient having surgery. Intoxication, this is either with alcohol or illegal drugs. Initial, for the patient's initial presentation of type 1 diabetes. And insulin, for the patient not taking enough or any insulin. So go through these questions and try to identify why the patient is in DKA and be sure to treat the underlying cause if they have one. Make sure to do a good history and physical, and don't just focus on the lab values. One caveat is that patients with the DKA will often complain of nausea, vomiting, and abdominal pain. The theory is that the electrolyte abnormalities cause the intestines to slow down, which causes an ileus. Keep in mind that an appendicitis or cholecystitis can also cause DKA, so if the patient has a concerning abdominal exam, then you need to investigate it with the appropriate imaging. Let's talk about the labs you want to get on these patients. First, CBC, Chem-10, UA, serum ketones plus or minus, a serum or urine HCG for females, a chest x-ray if the patient has respiratory symptoms, and a VBG. So let's go through each one of those individually. So CBC, so pretty much everyone gets a CBC, but you can also tell how dehydrated the patient is if their HNH is very high. Chem-10, this is very important for your electrolytes. We'll talk more about this later. And UA, you want to check for urine ketones or any signs of a UTI. Serum ketones, this is not entirely necessary if the patient has urinary ketones, but it's another data point. Serum or urine HCG for females, because all females are pregnant until proven otherwise. A chest x-ray if the patient has any respiratory symptoms that could suggest an pneumonia. And a VBG, you're most interested in the serum pH, but a lot of VBG panels give you the bicarb, and most can give you sodium and potassium before the lab can get back to you. Here's one quick warning about ketones in the urine and blood. In DKA, patients can produce the ketones acetoacetate and beta-hydroxybutyrate. The usual urine dipstick test that is used only detects the ketone acetoacetate, but it doesn't detect beta-hydroxybutyrate, which may lead you to think that the patient doesn't have ketones in their urine. There are serum tests for beta-hydroxybutyrate that you can order if the patient doesn't have urinary ketones and you're suspicious of DKA. Now let's talk about management of DKA. You may think that getting insulin into these patients is your first priority, but that can actually be harmful. Fluids are initially way more important than starting the patient on insulin. These patients are very dehydrated and they need fluids way more than they need insulin, at least initially. Patients with DKA are dehydrated from the inside out. The high blood sugar causes glucose to spill into the urine, and where glucose goes, water follows. As far as fluid management, if the patient is in shock manifested by tachycardia, low blood pressure, poor perfusion, and altered mental status, then you'll want to bolus in 2 or more liters of normal saline quickly. If the patient is not in shock, then you should get at least 1 liter of normal saline in the first hour. Be sure not to be too aggressive in the fluid replacement, because too much fluid can cause cerebral edema, which greatly increases mortality and morbidity in DKA. This is an especially big concern in pediatric patients with DKA, but we'll talk more about that later. you should initially think of a patient with DKA as someone who is very hypovolemic, who happens to have a high blood sugar, because correcting the fluid balance up front is very important and even trumps starting insulin until you have some labs back. The next big issue you'll have to deal with is the patient's potassium level. Patients with DKA don't have enough circulating insulin, which is needed to move potassium into the cells. Therefore, they lose potassium in their urine, so they have depleted their total body stores of potassium. Even though the patient's potassium may be normal or even slightly high, the entire body store of potassium will be low. Since these patients are potassium depleted, we don't want to slam the patient with insulin just because their blood sugar is high. Remember, we want to treat the patient, not a lab number. Slamming the patient with a lot of insulin can lead to cerebral edema, hypoglycemia, and arrhythmia if the potassium drops too low. Before you start any insulin, you must check the patient's potassium. If you start insulin and the patient's potassium is low, you'll drive all that potassium into the cells, and the patient can go into a dangerous and even fatal arrhythmia. So don't give insulin until you know the patient's potassium level. So let's talk now about potassium replacement. If the patient's potassium is under 3.3, then you need to hold any insulin until the potassium is over 3.3. What you'll want to do is add 20 to 30 milliequivalents of potassium to a liter of normal saline to your initial fluids and give that over an hour until the potassium is 3.3 or above. If the potassium is between 3.3 and 5, then you'll want to add 20 milliequivalents to each liter of fluid, but you can start insulin. If the potassium is above 5, then don't add any potassium to the fluids and start your insulin drip. This will ensure that your patient doesn't get hypokalemic. Let's go over that one more time for emphasis. If the patient's potassium is under 3.3, add 20 to 30 milliequivalents of potassium to the IV fluids and don't start insulin until the potassium is above 3.3. If the potassium is 3.3 to 5, add 20 milliequivalents of potassium to the IV fluids and start insulin. If the potassium is 5 or greater, don't add any potassium to the IV fluids and start insulin. Now we can finally talk about insulin therapy. The big question here is to bolus or not to bolus the insulin. Traditionally, DKA was treated with a bolus of insulin, followed by an insulin drip. However, we are getting away from giving that insulin bolus because it probably isn't necessary and can only cause problems. There are several studies that have shown that the outcomes are the same with or without an initial bolus of insulin. In addition, while it hasn't been confirmed in the literature, there is a thought that bolus insulin increases the rate of cerebral edema. We aren't sure whether the cerebral edema is from the bolus insulin or just a marker of bad DKA. My humble take on this is that if it doesn't do you any good, it may only possibly do harm, why do it? If you're going to give bolus insulin, the dose is 0.1 units per kilogram of regular insulin IV. The easy thing about this is that you set your insulin drip at the same dose per hour. So that's 0.1 units per kilogram per hour. So for your average 70 kilogram adult, that's a bolus of 7 units of regular insulin IV and 7 units per hour. This isn't a lot of insulin, but remember that I said that DKA management is more about your fluid and electrolyte balance than about how much insulin you give them. Just an FYI, some texts recommend a drip rate of 0.14 units per kilogram per hour if you don't use a bolus dose of insulin, but there isn't a consensus on this. If you can remember the different dose of 0.14 units per kilogram per hour, then that's great. Otherwise, there's no real data to say that 0.14 is better than 0.1 for a drip rate. One last initial concern is the patient's pH. If it is below 6.9, then some argue that it is appropriate to give the patient sodium bicarbonate. A pH below 6.9 represents severe DKA, but not everyone gives bicarb if the pH is below 6.9. If you choose to give bicarb, put 3 amps of sodium bicarb in a liter of D5W and run 400 cc's of this solution over 2 hours. Be careful not to mix sodium bicarb and normal saline. First of all, it will precipitate in the IV tubing, and in addition, the normal saline has too much sodium in it, and if you add the sodium bicarb on top of it, you now have a hypertonic solution of saline. Make sure to look this up before you do it, and do it right. You may even want to get your pharmacist involved to mix up the drip. So at this point, we've gone over the initial DKA management with fluids, potassium, insulin, and possibly bicarb. From there, we need to adjust the management to match the patient's improving status. Let's start with the IV fluids. Once you've given several liters of normal saline, get a repeat chemistry panel. First, calculate this corrected serum sodium by using a calculator online or on your phone. I'll include this calculation in the show notes. If the corrected serum sodium is low, continue normal saline at 250 to 500 cc's per hour. If the corrected serum sodium is normal or high, start half normal saline at 250 to 500 cc's per hour. Once the serum glucose reaches 200, start D5 half normal saline to provide glucose so the patient doesn't get hypoglycemic. As far as the insulin drip, once the patient's blood sugar gets below 200, reduce the rate of the insulin drip by half to 0.05 units per kilogram per hour, but don't shut it off. We'll go over why in a second. You'll want to maintain the blood sugar between 150 and 200 until the acidosis resolves. You'll know that the acidosis has resolved when the patient's anion gap goes back to normal. Now, the classic situation that new interns will deal with is that you'll get a page because the patient's blood sugar is normal, and the nurse will want to know if you want to stop the insulin. It's important that you keep the insulin drip going until the anion gap closes back to normal, or else the patient will go back into DKA. If the patient doesn't have enough insulin, they can't restore their electrolyte or glucose balance, and they can't get rid of their acidosis. If you have to, increase the D5 half-normal saline to give the patient more glucose to maintain their blood sugar. If the patient gets hypoglycemic, give an amp of D50 IV, but keep the insulin drip going until the anion gap returns to normal. Now, to give credit where credit is due, most nurses, especially ICU nurses, know about not shutting off the insulin drip too early in patients with the DKA, but it's happened in the past, so just be aware of what to do in that situation. The other important part is to continue to monitor the patient's labs. If the patient is very sick, you may be getting VBGs every 30 minutes and carefully monitoring the patient's response to therapy. At a minimum, I would check a finger stick, VBG, and Chem-10 every hour while in the emergency department. Now, if your VBG panel includes glucose, sodium, potassium, and bicarb in addition to your blood gases, then you can just run the VBG panel every hour. Patients in very mild DKA may be admitted to a step-down unit if your hospital has the appropriate staffing and protocols, but most of these patients will go to the ICU for close monitoring. Even though most patients go to the ICU, the reality is that we are boarding more patients in the ED for longer and longer periods of time, so we need to be sure that we can manage the patient for several hours, not just that first hour after they hit the door. Now, all this may sound very cookbook, and this is one area where following a treatment algorithm will be helpful so you don't forget anything. Once again, be sure to treat the patient and not the lab values. As far as HHS, the management is virtually the same. Just know that these patients tend to be more hypovolemic and will need more fluids than those with DKA. You probably won't see a big change in their potassium level since they still have circulating insulin, but they still need close monitoring of their electrolytes. Now let me just say a few quick words about pediatric DKA. This won't be a complete overview of pediatric DKA, just a few things to look out for. In preparing for this podcast, I enlisted the help of my wife, Kristen. She is a pediatrics resident, so I asked her what the latest and greatest in pediatric DKA management was. She told me the newest research is saying that you have to be careful about how much you bolus kids with DKA. The current research is saying that you don't want to give more than 45 cc's per kilogram of IV fluids in the first 4 hours, or else you may increase the incidence of cerebral edema. So this amounts to just over 2 boluses of 20 cc's per kilogram. The reason why we want to bolus these kids is that we're worried about shock and poor perfusion. However, one paper in Pediatric Neurology in 1999 showed that out of 195 patients with DKA at a single center, none had a shock at admission or during their stay, so shock doesn't seem to be a big issue in these patients. All of this being said, the data on fluid management in pediatric DKA is very scarce, and the management is controversial because of the difficulty of performing a good randomized trial. However, the Pokorn Research Group is currently investigating this issue, and will complete a trial in 2015, so look for that study in a few years. At the end of the day, my advice to you would be to just limit yourself to 1 bolus of 20 cc's per kilogram of IV fluids in the ED if you feel it's necessary. But don't bolus anymore without talking with the pediatric endocrinologist. If you are receiving a pediatric DKA patient transfer from another hospital, make sure to find out exactly how much fluid and how many boluses they have already received. As a final point, be sure to involve the patient's endocrinologist early in the treatment for recommendations because they follow these patients extremely closely and they want to hear as soon as we know that they are in DKA so that they can assist with their management. So let's summarize the main points. DKA is defined by a blood sugar over 250, ketones in the blood or urine, and a serum pH of 7.3 or less. Start by addressing their fluid status with normal saline to restore volume. Check the potassium and don't start insulin until you know it. Add potassium to the IV fluids as appropriate. Start insulin with or without a bolus, 0.1 units per kilogram bolus, followed by 0.1 units per kilogram per hour drip. Once the blood sugar is below 200, add D5 to the IV fluids and reduce the insulin drip by half. Finally, keep the insulin drip going until the anion gap is normal. In pediatric patients with DKA, limit your fluid bolus to 120 cc per kg bolus in the ED if you think they need it, and get your pediatric endocrinologist involved early. That's all I have for now. I hope that this was helpful in understanding how we diagnose and treat DKA. Feel free to follow EM Basic on Twitter under the name EM Basic, and drop me an email at steve@embasic.org with any comments or suggestions for future show topics. This episode was a suggestion from a resident in my program, so I do listen to any suggestions that come my way. Until next time, this is Steve Carroll for the EM Basic Podcast, signing off.